Miss today's newscast? Worry not. At KPFA, we get it. Life moves fast. That's why every headline, every deep dive, every voice that matters is waiting for you at kpfa.org. Head to the archives and catch the latest broadcast on your time. When time slips away, KPFA's got you. KPFA, vigilant as always.
You can touch that dial, but you're not going to like what's waiting. This is 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1
90.7 KFCF FM in KPFK, Fresno, Los Angeles.
Tell a friend.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
I'm Lucy Kane. In a dark warehouse space, dancers dressed in blue tank tops and shorts cradle small wooden beds. They move the beds around their bodies, pressing their faces into them at one point. The movements seem both intimate and melancholy. It's October 2023, and I'm watching a dance performance in San Francisco called If I Give You My Sorrows from Flyaway Productions. And the bed will show up again and again in different positions and sizes. For an hour, performers will dance with and around beds, small ones and large ones, and one that swings through the air as they twist and glide around it. But these are not just any beds. These beds are meant to evoke prison beds.
So the piece used the beds as a physical and metaphoric frame to look at the experience of women who are currently incarcerated.
This is Jo Kreider, artistic director of Flyaway Productions and the creative director of If I Give You My Sorrows.
I've been working with artists and people who are incarcerated since 2017. So with this piece, we asked the women, how is your bed an antidote to your prison experience?
Jo knows what it's like to have had an incarcerated loved one. She's created an entire series of work around the experiences of incarcerated people, including three site-specific productions in the Decarceration Trilogy. And for this show, she interviewed currently and formerly incarcerated women, sometimes for hours.
And I asked them, tell me about a bed. Tell me about your prison bed. What is a secret that only your bed knows about you? Tell me about your childhood bed. Tell me about your ideal bed. And from those questions emerged a picture of both the struggle of being in prison and the ways that women, or the women we spoke to at least, adapt.
Those words were then incorporated into some of the music composed for the performance, like this piece that includes the voice of formerly incarcerated trans activist Lisa Strawn.
This is Lisa Strawn. I'm a trans woman, and I recently was paroled after 25 years from San Quentin. I can't even begin. I can't even begin to tell you the fear, not just myself, but everyone else had every day.
The bed is portrayed as a kind of repository for deeply private feelings and thoughts. To me, it feels like this idea of the bed challenges the ways that the prison industrial complex dehumanizes the people inside, where incarcerated human beings are often euphemistically referred to in budgets as beds. Art, though, can show the human beings inhabiting those beds, whether through dance, visual art, or the written word. It has the power to reveal what's hidden. It can peel back the layers of censorship that are inherent to incarceration. One of the people Joe Kreider interviewed for the dance performance was Betty McKay, also known as Ms. Betty. Ms. Betty was formerly incarcerated and started off as an advocate inside prison.
I was incarcerated for 27 years. And that is a lot, particularly for women, because we are at the bottom of the totem pole for everything. I became a voice inside because we didn't have voices. And it's hard to get people to stand up to the system when you're inside because of retaliation. If you try to address an issue or you try to bring light to something, you could end up like in another prison, way away from your children, your loved ones, everything.
Joe approached Miss Betty about contributing to the dance piece.
And she was just like, Betty, I want you to tell your story, and we're going to do it into dance. And I was like, what? My story? And she was like, yes, you have a story. And so I just, I showed up at the studio. They put me in a booth. They asked me a million questions. I answered as authentically as I could. It got emotional at times. Just the memories of some of the things that I went through touched me. I didn't know that I still had triggers to things from my incarceration, but I did. And a lot of that came through in the dance, and you heard me saying the words. When I heard them, I got emotional at the performance. My bed now, when I came home, my bed now is the antidote for a lot of things. I look at my room now and I be like, thank you, Lord, thank you. Rubbing my body on those satin sheets. My bed now, my bed is a confidant, satin sheets.
Wow. I mean, I just remember when I was watching the performance, just being so struck by your words in particular. And I went back through and listened to it again before this interview. And just, you know, the words and the music, and I think the emotion, you know, really, really comes through in that section. And there's a line where you say something like, my bed now, when I came home, is an antidote to a lot of things. And I'm just wondering, could you describe what you meant by that?
Oh, I don't know why I'm just like almost crying right here, right now, thinking of that. Because what I know to be true is that the bed, it was like I never really thought about my bed. But my bed was like the only place that I could be like totally authentic with myself. Like I could cry in my bed, because even though I was someone in the prison that everyone looked for to solve problems and to make things happen and to do different things, every day wasn't a good day for me. But I couldn't be like that outside of that bed. That bed is the only place that I could be alone with myself and my thoughts.
27 years. It was hard, very hard. 27 years. And every day, and just lie there.
Just like to encourage people to take the time to reimagine who and what incarcerated people are and what they can do and what they're capable of. Because what I know to be true is that what I did to be in prison isn't who I am. It's what I did. Everyone has a story. And you don't know me unless you know my story. So you can't judge me unless you know my story.
This project made me reconsider what my bed means to me, which I hadn't thought of much before. It made me think of how the bed as an object, this piece of furniture I use every day that's made specifically for my rest, holds so much intimacy and care. But that also makes the absence of the system of care in prisons and other carceral facilities so stark in comparison.
It was hard in there. And some days was harder than others. And some days that bed was comforting. And so it's like everything that I went through, everything that I was feeling in my heart, in my soul, could only be shared with my bed. And when I came home, once I got a job and had a little bit of money and was able to get a little bit of credit, the bed was the first thing I bought. That was the first thing I bought for myself after 27 years of incarceration, was the bed. And right now, today, that bed still means the same thing to me.
In the next half of the show, we're going to look more closely at a related art exhibition and what it tells us about how people outside prison walls, including those who are formerly incarcerated, can support and uplift the voices of women inside. The question that Joe Kreider built the dance performance around was, how is your bed an antidote? And that question was also used as a prompt for a visual art and poetry exhibition called The Only Door I Can Open, featuring work from artists and writers inside Central California Women's Prison, or CCWF, in Chowchilla. The exhibition, like the dance piece, was a collaboration between Empowerment Avenue, the Museum of the African Diaspora, and Flyaway Productions. Two women currently inside that prison curated and contributed to The Only Door I Can Open. You'll hear their voices in the rest of the episode. They were recorded on calls made from inside prison, and as you'll be able to tell, the prison phones don't have the best quality, and you'll also hear how that quality changes depending on which recording we used. Here's one of the exhibition's curators, writer and poet Tamikia Johnson.
You know, we all have to process a really abstract question that some of us probably never considered, and that was, well, you know, what is our bed? A woman's bed here is much more than where she puts pajamas on, goes to sleep, wakes up. You know, it's so much more than that.
Artist and writer Chantel Jeanette Black is the other curator. She's been a painter since before she was incarcerated.
So for a lot of us, our bed was that sanctuary, which is expressed either in poetry or through visual art. And so we kind of like got to expose that suppression through how we are under constant surveillance. We're always exposed in our most vulnerable moments.
When it first launched, The Only Door I Can Open was shown in a gallery space near the dance performance venue in San Francisco. Paintings, drawings, and works with poetry hung on the walls. And what stood out to me was just how differently the artists responded to the question about their beds. One of the pieces on display was a poem Tamikia wrote called My Bunk Bed as an Antidote. This poem is where the title of the exhibition came from. Here's an excerpt recorded in her voice from within the prison.
I've been giving it some thought about how the only door I can open in prison is an invisible one leading to my bunk bed. It calls me when it wants and needs me. Sometimes it betrays my insomnia, giving me a few drips of sleep.
I want to turn now to look at what it took for Tamikia and Chantel to curate the show from inside prison. One of the first steps was finding other incarcerated artists to work with. That wasn't easy because of the restrictions placed on them by the prison. Plus, the planning process took place during COVID lockdowns. Here's Chantel.
It was very challenging within this particular institution because I believe we are currently the nation's or one of the top largest prisons within the world. And so it's very big for a women's institution specifically, not in comparison to men's. We have three separate yards. And within those three separate yards, we can't really intermix. Like, I'm not allowed on another yard.
The yards are named alphabetically. During the time that they were planning the show, Tamikia was in C as in Charlie Yard, while Chantel was in B as in Bravo Yard. When the project kicked off, they were in the same yard, but then later got moved to different ones. So they used a go-between, but not a person. It was a notebook, one of those lined composition journals I remember from school.
Tamika and I came up with a wonderful plan of a notebook that we can pass around. So when you go to education or medical or the law library or wherever we go where we know we can meet up, we can pass the notebook and say, can you get this to so-and-so? Can you get this to the next unit? And then people, it's like a prison culture to say, like, can you pass this notebook or can you pass this letter to somebody? That it's pretty common to do that. That is one tool that we use to overcome the barrier of being separated, being on quarantine, and having limited access to one another.
The notebook included a description of the project and a list of potential artists that grew as the notebook made its way around the prison.
It took a lot of effort to coordinate between Tamika and I to get that notebook between the yards. We would meet on main yard at the law library and be able to switch it off there and pass it around. And sometimes it was definitely during COVID, so we had to wait a few weeks at times.
Chantel explains their strategy through a phone call. Halfway through, you'll hear an automated voice break in. It's just one reminder of the many limitations on communications inside prisons.
So because of the COVID quarantines and the limited networking and person skills, we had to do a little more of by word. So, you know, by word of mouth, so through the grapevine, like, do you know any...
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
And we kind of had a trust on reputation.
Then, once the artists were selected, Chantel and Tamikia worked with them to produce their pieces. Here's Tamikia again.
I offered them art supplies. I helped them write their biographies, artist statements, art descriptions, and I broke down the value of their pieces, teaching them how to evaluate them.
Prisons, jails, and detention centers are built on the logic of confinement, of surveillance, and of erasure from public life. And that means the voices of people who are incarcerated are routinely censored, even though they are the only ones who can really speak to the human impacts of incarceration. Chantel also made work for the show. One really stood out to me. Letter to My Bed features a poem painted onto a bedsheet with images of a tree, moon, and sun.
And I actually wrote the letter on an actual sheet. It is a PIA, and that's Prison Industry Authority sheet that we are all issued when we come into the prison. We each get two sheets, a pillowcase, and the basics.
The California Prison Industry Authority sheets are made by incarcerated people and distributed inside prisons for them to use.
And in the prison, in this particular prison, they put eight women in one room, which is about 18 by 18 feet, square feet. So it's not a lot of space. Your bunk space is really where we live, cook, do our homework, our study time, our meditations, our reflection. And with eight other people in the room, the only way you can feel like you're alone is by hanging up a sheet, either clipping it up or tying a shoelace from one end of the bunk post to the other end and hang your sheet over it. So I wrote a letter thanking the sheet for the privacy and the solitude that it gives me with the illusion of separating myself in my own little space from everyone else.
Chantel then painted the words and images onto the sheet with a paintbrush, working with a paperclip for the finest lines. She then used a hairdryer to heat set the paint so the sheet could be washed. Here's an excerpt from that poem in her own voice.
I am utmost grateful for the illusion of privacy that you provide when I hang my sheet across your line. You have been my only resource for healing the abundance of scars within and without. It is only here where I can close my eyes and be the mother I was meant to be, where I can hold her again, laugh and play with my family. I can release all the tears built from grief through the years. Time has no meaning other than knowing the world outside continues without me.
As curators of The Only Door I Can Open, Chantel and Tamikia were supported by the organization Empowerment Avenue. I first heard about Empowerment Avenue through their projects to help writers who are incarcerated get their work published. The organization's executive director is Rahsaan New York Thomas. You might have heard him as a host on the award-winning podcast Ear Hustle.
This program got started because I needed it. I was in prison and I was writing about what I was witnessing. I became a person who was working for the newsroom, writing articles for San Quentin News. I became a co-host of Ear Hustle, and I also got involved in making documentary films. But I needed more. I felt like the economic piece was missing. And I felt like at a certain point, I was just preaching to the same people, preaching to the choir. And so I longed to get my voice past the choir to bigger ponds and to like get economically compensated for it. And at the same time, I was watching the artists around me give their art away to nonprofits. So economic empowerment was critical. And so Empowerment Avenue started as a concept that I saw was necessary because as a writer, I only got 8 stories published in 7 years and only made $400 on my own. But meanwhile, there was a guy I was incarcerated with. He had made a connection with an editor at a magazine who not only hired him to be a columnist, but acted as a person who would help him pitch his stories to other organizations. And he was getting published left and right. And I was like, man, not only do I need somebody like that, everybody needs somebody like that if you're a writer and you're incarcerated.
Editors who are willing to work with writers inside prisons provide really crucial access to platforms that are otherwise denied to them. And Empowerment Avenue tries to facilitate relationships that get incarcerated artists and writers published and paid. Rahsaan was an interesting person to talk to for this story because he's also worked as an art curator. That's during his time inside San Quentin.
First of all, I start out like not knowing how to curate anything, but just knowing that certain artwork was beautiful to me and wanting to share that artwork, what I saw with the world.
So Rahsaan knows firsthand about the challenges that Chantel and Tamikia went through. And just like them, he had to learn how to manage time. Things sometimes take longer in prison, like longer than you think, especially during the height of COVID lockdowns.
I kind of plan for it. Like, I know that prison's going lockdown, so I can't wait till the last minute. You have to work ahead of time and not behind and make it happen. I think the most interesting part for me is as a curator for the first time, I'm asking people to give me their artwork in January, in December, in November for a show that basically almost a year away, 9-10 months away. And so they have to trust my vision, right? They have to believe in me. And so having those relationships with all these guys in place was really key. And I'm honored that they did trust me. They all gave me their artwork. Then everybody in that exhibit made $600 off the top. And so I'm really proud of that. That we were able to do that and set a new trend. Like normally when you're in a museum, all you get is exposure. This time we got the guys paid.
Rahsaan took what he had learned and wrote a guide to share with Chantel and Tamikia as they prepared to curate The Only Door I Can Open. It was just one way that he and his colleague, Christine Lashaw, Director of Visual Arts for Liberation, supported them.
From start to finish, it was a lot of teamwork, a lot of communication, a lot of letter writings, and a lot of phone calls. This is the first exhibit I have ever curated or co-curated.
Honestly, this project, this whole exhibit would not be possible without the collaborative teamwork and open line of communication that Tamika and I both had with Empowerment Avenue. And I always felt like I was included, like my voice was being heard. And we moved into the actual production days. They did a video visit with me where I could see the actual art space, the museum space. I got videograms of the dance production. Like, it was so thorough and so professional. It exceeded all my expectations.
For Rahsaan, it was especially important to uplift the voices of incarcerated women. Incarceration impacts the over 190,000 women and girls currently held in prisons, jails, and correctional and detention centers in the United States differently than it does men.
I feel like women are not given the honor and respect that they deserve in this world in general. And incarcerated women, forget about it. For example, the men's prison has access to all its art supplies and a thriving art program. And the women's prison did not have that. And they're the fastest growing prison population. And Chowchilla is one of the, if not the biggest, women's facility in the country, if not the world. And so we need to shine some light on how things are done there and what needs to be improved.
In fact, the Prison Policy Initiative says that, quote, women in prison are worse off than men, both leading up to and during their incarceration. And that's troubling because the number of women being incarcerated is rising at double the rate of men. And the thing is, we don't really know why that is, because the data is inconsistent or incomplete. And gender-based violence definitely plays a role. Women are often incarcerated for fighting back against their abusers. Incarcerated women are 3 times as likely as men to be sexually abused by prison or jail staff. And that's for women across the board, without slicing it down even further into women of color and queer and trans women. Prisons and other carceral institutions are dehumanizing, but art can push against that. It can remind us of the brutality, punishment, and control inherent to prisons, and instead help us imagine communities that are built on care, care that acknowledges our humanity, like healthcare for everyone, and education and housing, and having a bed that's not in a cage. Here's Chantel.
So the thing that's really important that I hope people get as this exhibit is to see the humanity and individuality of women incarcerated. Having an artistic platform to speak up and be heard, that is invaluable to me. It's just so precious and important for each one of us to be able to speak up and be heard and seen as the mothers, daughters, sisters that we are, not what the media portrays people incarcerated to be.
The only door I can open, and if I give you my sorrows, are collaborations between Flyaway Productions, Empowerment Avenue, and the Museum of the African Diaspora.
This is Donna Walker, host of Pacifica Performance Showcase, airing on Friday afternoons from 2:30 to 3 p.m. right here on KPFK. Covering film, theater, music, and literature, it's arts and culture to enlighten, enliven, and educate. Right here on KPFK 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kpfk.org.
It's one thing to love public radio, but it's a special thing to support it. Consider this. If you've got a car you don't need anymore, or you've got one that is simply too expensive to repair, arrange to donate it to KPFK. It's easy for you, pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thanks in advance, and here is how to get started. Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288. That is 1-877-KPFK-AUTO. And learn more.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
Both fighters being called to the center of the ring.
Listen, my comments. Heads up.
I'm Salima Hamouraini, and to start us off today, we're going to go back to August 1st at the 2024 Paris Olympics to a boxing match between Amani Khalif and Angela Karim.
A final welterweight fight of the session between Algeria and Italy, and we're off.
At first, Khalif and Karini weave back and forth, and Karini lands a punch. And then all of a sudden, Karini walks to the corner of the ring, and she pauses.
Karini just asking to get her head guard tightened in.
She comes back out to fight, and quickly, Khalif lands a punch.
Solid straight right hand from Khalif there.
And then all of a sudden, Karini quits. 46 seconds into the match, she retreats to the corner.
Well, demonstrating from Karini. She talks to her corner. She's not happy about something.
She's been shouting, "It's not fair, it's not fair." Meanwhile, Khalif looks sullen and worried.
We'll wait on the results here.
By abandon. Victorious by abandon. In red from Algeria.
Khalif wins this fight because Karini quits after one punch, less than 1 minute into the fight. But Khalif doesn't look triumphant in this moment. Her face looks confused. This fight, this 46-second match, began a firestorm in this year's Olympics. Almost immediately, commentators flooded Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Khalif, the Algerian fighter, they said, is not a woman. She's secretly a man. They argued that Karini quit because she was hit so hard by a man that she didn't feel as if it was fair to continue. She was in danger during the fight. Elon Musk and J.K. Rowling got involved.
Rowling using incorrect pronouns, tweeting that Khalif was enjoying the distress of a woman he's just punched in the head and whose life's ambitions he's just shattered.
Former President Trump jumped into the fray, saying that if he was elected, he'd forbid men from competing in women's sports. But here's the thing. Imani Khalif isn't a man. That's Khalif speaking out about the controversy later, saying, "I'm a woman, like any other woman. I was born a woman. I have lived as a woman. I compete as a woman. There is no doubt about that." So why did everybody suddenly become convinced that she was not a woman? That's the topic of today's show. The extreme focus on proving women's identities in sports. And to help us understand what's going on with gender in the Olympics, I sat down with Rose Eveleth.
I am the host and reporter behind a new podcast called Tested, which is about sex testing, past, present, and future, unfortunately, probably.
Rose has been investigating gender testing in sports, especially in track and field, for over a decade. Okay, Rose, so start us off. Why did people start making this accusation that Khalif was a man? Was it based on her appearance? Like, what was it?
So it's a couple of things. I think some people will say things like, well, just look at her, right? Clearly, she doesn't look like a woman, which, of course, is completely subjective. The other thing that's happening here is that last year, in the spring of 2023, the IBA, the International Boxing Association, held a meeting and they disqualified these two boxers, Khalif and Lynn. And they did so because they claimed that these boxers had failed some unspecified laboratory test about their gender. And it is still very unclear what test was done. They've gone back and forth. They've said it was testosterone. And then they said, no, no, it's not testosterone. It's chromosomes. It was all very confusing. But in the spring of last year, they disqualified these two boxers. And it was very strange because it was sort of in the middle of an event, the big sort of international tournament for boxing. And so because some people, I guess, knew about this past disqualification, they sort of resurfaced this idea that perhaps Khalif is not somehow a woman, which, of course, is not the case.
And why do they single out Khalif and Lynn?
We don't really know. It's I think, just based on appearance, right? I think it's that they seemed somehow not womanly enough. But there's not, it's not clearly written out in the meeting minutes what it was that flagged these two women in particular.
But also, the IBA has had its own controversies, right? Which have predated this particular gender scandal. Is there a reason we should be wary of what the IBA claims it discovered during those tests?
Yes. So the IBA is fraught, to put it maybe nicely. The IBA is the International Boxing Association. They used to be known as the AIBA. They've sort of gone through different iterations. And the IBA has been in hot water for many years, since about 2019, because there have been allegations of corruption, of unethical practices, of all sorts of things that actually have nothing to do with sex testing at all. They were already kind of in trouble. And so in 2019, the IOC actually gave them kind of a laundry list of things, saying, look, if you want to maintain your status as the recognized International Federation for Boxing, you need to clean up your act. You got to do this, this, this. And the IBA essentially didn't do those things. And so a couple of months after this meeting at which these two boxers were disqualified, the IOC stripped the IBA of recognition.
The IOC, the International Olympic Committee, has since come out in support of Khalif with a rare, very rare, progressive statement on gender.
They have competed and they continue to compete in the women's competition. They have lost and they have won against other women throughout over the years. But testosterone is not a perfect test. Many women can have testosterone, which is in what would be called male levels, and still be women and still compete as women. So this panacea, this idea that suddenly you test, do one test for testosterone and that sorts everything out, not the case, I'm afraid.
And keep those words in mind from the IOC, because that is not how they've normally thought about gender. Rose, so the other thing about the kind of like truly horrifying media obsession with Khalif's gender is that it's not new. And in your podcast, you talk about the earliest Olympics and how this immediately became a problem when the very first women began competing. Can you talk to me a little bit about the history of gender testing in sports?
Yeah, so one of the things I think is the most surprising about the history of sex testing is just how old it is, how long ago we started doing this. So in 1928, it's the first year that women are allowed to compete in track and field. Now, women had been allowed to compete in the Olympics before 1928, but they were only allowed in sports that were deemed at the time more feminine. So things like swimming or tennis. Track and field was seen as the manliest of man sports. If you were a real man, you competed in track and field. And so in 1928, when women are allowed to compete, essentially right off the bat, as soon as women hit the track, you hear people talking in newspapers, you know, quotes, all these headlines saying, there is something wrong with these women. That woman looks too muscular. That woman looks too strong. The woman who won silver in the 800 meters in 1928, Hitomi Kinue, who's a Japanese runner, people said things like, you know, she had all the power of a halfback, right? Talking about how they had these muscles. There was something wrong with them. And that sort of begins sex testing. So, you know, you have a couple of anecdotal stories about women being pulled aside. There was a story about Hitomi Kinue being pulled aside and examined. There's a story about Helen Stevens, an American runner, being pulled aside and examined. And then in 1936, you get the first sort of on the books policy for track and field saying that if there are what they called questions of a physical nature, you could take them aside and you could examine them.
Wait, when you say examined, what do you mean?
Yeah, it was purely visual. There's not a lot of good documentation about exactly what test would be done. And I sort of often don't even like to call it a test because really it is a visual exam. It means that you take someone aside and in the best case scenario, you ask them to go to their doctor and ask them to get like essentially a doctor's note that says, you know, we've examined this woman and she's a woman. But in the worst case scenario, you wind up with a sports official taking a woman aside and asking her to, again, get naked so that they can examine her body and make sure that, I guess, her vulva looks correct in some way. And again, this is not written down. They don't write down exactly what they'd be looking for. It's all very vague.
It should be pointed out here that the 1936 Olympics that Rose mentions were the Berlin Olympics, which took place during the height of the Nazi regime in Germany. At the time, there were huge boycotts asking the U.S. to pull out of the games because of the Nazis. But while the persecution of Germany's Jewish population was taking place in the background, what were Olympic officials worried about? If the women were feminine enough. This has always been an underlying worry. Are the women competing feminine and attractive enough for men to want to look at?
Yeah, I mean, Avery Brundage, who is a really critical figure in the period of the 30s, 40s, even to the 50s, he's really the instrumental American sports official who pushes the United States to not boycott the 1936 Nazi Olympics, right? He is the reason largely that the U.S. stays in those games, because he had a lot of friends in the Nazi Party and was quite sympathetic to the Nazi cause. You know, he talks fairly explicitly about one of the reasons why he doesn't like women participating in sports is because he finds it unattractive. He does not find it attractive to watch women exert themselves, because when you run really hard, you know, you make a weird face and you look like you're trying really hard. And that was just sort of disgusting to him. And he doesn't really mince words about that. He's very straightforward about it.
But even in Nazi Germany, testing was on a case-by-case basis. And that changes in the 1960s.
And then in 1966, rather than abandoning sex testing, the governing body of track and field decides that actually they needed to test every single woman, that doing it on a case-by-case basis wasn't enough. And so they roll out something called the nude parades, which are unfortunately quite what they sound like. Women were asked to go into a room and get naked and be examined by someone, usually a doctor, that they don't know, to make sure that their basically genitals look correct and they looked like a woman. That also was called the peek and poke tests by some of the athletes at the time.
Rose actually managed to interview athletes who underwent the peek and poke tests for their podcast Tested. Here's Carol Martin, who was a young 18-year-old athlete at the time that she competed in Jamaica in 1966 at an international competition.
I remember we were taken under the stands before the competition into a large room and had to pull my pants down in front of this woman so she could see I had a vagina. I remember thinking, what the f*** is this? This seems a little invasive. This seems a little inappropriate.
This part was really astonishing to me in Rose's podcast, because men have never undergone this kind of scrutiny, just women. The nude parades were incredibly unpopular for obvious reasons, and they were successfully banned in 1968. But by then, science had progressed, and we were able to start checking for testosterone and for chromosomes, which gave the IOC new tools with which to examine gender.
So between 1968-ish and 1999, every woman who competed at the Olympics had to go into a room, get their cheek swabbed, and take this chromosome test. And if you passed it, you were given a little card, a certificate of femininity, they were called. And then it would say, like, certified female, check. And you had to bring that with you to every event you wanted to compete at. But so then in 1999, they drop that. And they drop it because there has been truly 30 years. I mean, basically since the very beginning, there have been doctors and experts begging the IOC to drop this test because it is not a reliable test of sex or gender. Having a Y chromosome does not necessarily make you a man. There are, some estimates say 1 in 500 women have Y chromosomal material in some or all of their cells. You or I might have Y chromosomes. We might just not know, because why would we know that? And so eventually in 99, they drop that test. And then in 2009, you sort of see this pick up again after Caster Semenya, who some people may know, ran in Berlin. And now we're sort of in this testosterone era where, rather than thinking that the chromosome is the core thing, now we're really focused on testosterone. So it's been this kind of, I almost like to describe it as like a game of whack-a-mole a little bit, where everyone is just searching for this one singular test to tell who's a woman and who's not. And there isn't one. And so you just keep kind of hitting the moles as they pop out of the ground. And each one of them is their own kind of weird little test that we try to do. But there's just no way easily to do this.
Okay, but why can't we find one single test to tell us whether or not someone is a man or a woman? Well, because human sex is a beautifully varied, complicated thing, and there's no easy way to divide the sexes into a binary, no matter how much the IOC wants to. Stay tuned, we're going to dig into what makes a man and what makes a woman, or not, right after the break.
I'm jumping in to remind you that you are listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. Okay, now back to the show.
Welcome back to Making Contact. Today we're talking about sex testing at the Olympics. In the first half of the show, we talked about the history of gender testing in sports and the incredibly invasive way women, not men, have been singled out in order to prove their gender identities. But while we might have social ideas about what makes a man and what makes a woman, in the biological realm, there's no clear binary. And we're back in the second half with Rose Evelyn, host and producer of the podcast Tested, which you can find links to on our website. Rose, there are a lot of components to biological sex that make us, quote, male or female. And I'm just curious, how common are variations? How many of us, for example, who identify as women might have high testosterone, for example, without even knowing?
Yeah, it's a great question that's actually hard to answer because, as you say, most people don't know, right, their chromosomal makeup, their testosterone level, right? Like, most people just don't know that. So we don't really know exactly how common it is, depending on the definition. So there's all sorts of things that can vary in human sex biology. You can have XXY chromosomes. You can have XYY chromosomes. Men can have XX chromosomes. You know, you can have internal testes but also have breasts and a vagina. You can have really high levels of testosterone. Some women have really, really high levels of testosterone, but they have what's called androgen insensitivity, and so they can't actually process that testosterone. So there's sort of a million different variations that can happen here. Intersex advocates sometimes call it sort of a symphony, right? That there's all different instruments that can get played to kind of combine to make whatever your sort of unique biological makeup is. And depending on who you ask and how you define these terms, there are some estimates that say that between 1 and 2% of the population has some kind of variation in their sex biology. So this is not exceedingly rare. It's not a super uncommon thing. And I think, you know, many people would perhaps be surprised to learn their biology. Actually, I was just talking to a neighbor of mine, and she told me that recently she was diagnosed with high testosterone, and she had her whole life, she had no idea. And she was joking. She was like, I'm not good at sports, you know, didn't give me any kind of advantage. And so I think this is just actually far more common than people realize.
And then, of course, gender and sex are different concepts. You can be assigned one gender at birth, but know yourself to have a different identity than the one that you were assigned. The difference between sex and gender didn't exist as a concept back in the 20s and 30s, but there have always been trans people. And there was a consistent fear back in the early days of sports that if a woman was too athletic, she would spontaneously turn into a man.
So at the time, in the 20s and 30s, and even into the 40s, there was this idea called balance theory. And you have to remember, this is before we really know very much about human chromosomes. So they had this idea that every person was born with basically like a little bit of man stuff and a little bit of lady stuff. And your balance was what sort of made your sex or gender. And so they believed that you could be kind of a 65% woman or a 90% woman. And what they worried about is that if you were already kind of maybe a what they called a borderline case, somebody who was maybe only 65% a woman, if you did things that men do, like, for example, play elite sports, you could actually shift your balance and you could tip over into maleness, quite literally turn into men. At the time, you see local newspapers reporting this where people would allegedly get sick, right? Get really sick, and then they would get better, and that sickness will have tipped them over. And so you'll see these sort of amazing articles where they say, you know, like, Johnny got really sick, and now he's Jane, and that's fine. And we're all fine with that, because we all know that's a thing that can happen, is you get sick, and it tips your balance, and then you become something else. And so you see these stories, essentially, of transition happening, but blamed on sickness that kind of balances, tips the balance. And so there was this worry that if you took these, again, borderline cases, and you allowed these women who were already kind of maybe close to the edge of being men, and you allowed them to compete in sports, they would accidentally turn themselves into men, and they needed to be protected against that.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, the newspaper articles of people transitioning, when I read them, they weren't as horrifying as I thought. And in fact, there was almost more of an acceptance of trans identities than there is now.
Yeah, it is always a little bit both incredible and sometimes depressing when you see something like this, where you realize that perhaps, you know, 1920s ideas around acceptance of trans people are maybe we're in a better place than we are now, you know, not always great. And also, it's sort of interesting, right, because obviously balance theory is not like correct, quote unquote, scientifically, but in some ways, it's actually spiritually or like philosophically much closer to the realities of human sex biology, right? Which is that it is a spectrum. There are all sorts of variations. It is not this really rigid binary where there is XX, XY, testosterone and, you know, estrogen. Like, you know, today I think people really have this sense of a very rigid, dichotomous, you know, sex binary. And that's not true. And in fact, balance theory, while certainly not accurate is maybe a framing that is slightly more true in the spirit of the thing, in the sense that we have this spectrum that we're talking about.
Okay, so we have this 1 to 2% gender variation that is possible among all humans across all races, right? But you mentioned in your podcast that all of the women you talked to who were pulled aside for testing were Black and brown women from the global south. So what's going on here?
Yeah, I think it's a huge piece of this conversation. I think there are a couple of reasons why. When it comes to specifically people who are being flagged for what are sort of broadly called DSD, differences of sex development. When we talk about women who are being flagged and suddenly being told, like Khalif saying, like, you don't look like a woman, we're going to force you to test. As far as I know, there are no white women who have been in the last, since 2009, who have been flagged in this way. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that in most sports, these tests are not blanket tests. So we are no longer testing every single woman the way that we were in the 60s through the 90s. And so what that means is that there are only certain women who are being flagged as quote unquote suspicious. And that accusation often does come down to visuals, what somebody looks like. And there's a really long history of racist assumptions about who looks like a woman and what womanhood looks like, what femininity looks like. There is a very long, well-documented history of white supremacy essentially telling people that Black women, brown women don't look like women, that they look actually like men.
For example, non-white, non-Western women can sometimes have more body hair. That is enough to get you flagged for gender testing.
There's also, I think, another element here, which is sort of healthcare disparity. So in general, on average, and these are sort of sweeping generalizations, but babies that are born in the global north tend to be born in hospital settings and tend to be going to pediatric checkups and kind of have these what they call touch points to care, right? They're going to the doctor more. And in that case, often that means that if you do have some of these variations in sex biology, you might be diagnosed early.
And they're sometimes treated for it, which is highly controversial in of itself. Many women in the global south don't know that they have a difference in sex development until they're suddenly tested by the IOC. But that might be changing.
Because we're seeing a shift in the ways in which the global north thinks about these kinds of treatments, right? Because often those treatments involve things like genital surgeries to try and make them more like one or the other sex. And those are unnecessary and, you know, in some ways damaging. And so maybe I've heard people speculate that in 10 years, you're going to see a bunch of white folks who get into the same position where they're 18 and suddenly being told, actually, you have this thing and actually you need to, you know about it or change your body in some ways. And it will be very interesting to see if that changes the conversation that we're having right now. But that's another thing that's going on. So it's kind of both things in concert with one another.
Yeah. And again, given the variability in humans, why is there this extreme focus on women? Have men ever been scrutinized? I mean, there are probably men with low testosterone or high testosterone or intersex men competing in the Olympics too, right?
No. Men do not get questioned. Men can have as much testosterone as they like. Good for you. And that's fine. And the reason for that, when you ask about this, the reason that you get is that the male category is not a protected category. The women's category is protected. And we need to protect the women's category because if we didn't, then men would enter women's sports and they would win everything because men are better at sports than women. And so we need to protect the female category because otherwise it would be unfair to the real women who are competing in these groups. Because if you allow men or people with what they call male-like bodies or whatever other euphemism you want to use here to compete, it won't be fair.
Okay, so I've heard this before about the protected category. So the idea is that someone is secretly a man and that they're unfairly trying to win medals by competing in the women's category. So we have to make sure that everybody in the women's category is actually a woman. My question is, has that actually ever happened?
At the elite level, as far as we know, no. So, you know, obviously there are like road races wherever, you know, who knows. But at the Olympic level, as far as I know, and I've been reporting this for many, many years, 10 years now, and I've talked to as many historians as I can, we have no evidence of any case of a man, quote unquote, masquerading as a woman. Now, we do have cases of women pretending to be men to compete because they've been barred from things like the marathon. So we do have cases of the reverse happening, but we do not know of any cases of at the elite level of men pretending to be women to compete.
Okay, so given all of this information, I have one final question for you. the binary in sports seems like it's pretty limiting. It also ignores a lot of human biology and sexual development. So how do we deal with this in the future? Do we get rid of the binary, or do we change the way that we organize athletes and, I don't know, weight classes or something?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I think there are kind of different layers to it, right? And so I think the sort of baseline level is that if you're a woman, you should be allowed to compete in the women's category. And that, to me, goes for trans athletes as well as for, you know, athletes with DSD variations and all of that. Then there's this question, I think, of non-binary athletes, right? And I think there are, in some cases, it makes sense to give a non-binary category, right? For example, a couple of marathons and half marathons have opened up a non-binary category, and that's great. That is not something that you should force someone into. I've seen people suggest that, you know, these intersex athletes or athletes with sex variation should be just given their own category. And that feels quite othering, I think, to those women who say, you know, all the women I talk to for Tested, they say, but I'm a woman. Like, they don't have any questions about their gender. They don't have gender dysphoria. But I also think that more big picture, when we talk about, like, what is the future of sports, it may be that in some sports we should not have a gender binary and then everyone should compete together. It may be that in some sports we should, or that maybe we should think about dividing sports by some other category like height or, you know, weight classes like they do in boxing or something like that. And so I think that there are so many potential ways to think about this that can be really interesting, but that are hard to get at because we spend so much of our time debating the human rights of, you know, people who are don't fall neatly into these categories. And so I think there's all sorts of really interesting things that we could potentially talk about, but we're just not there yet because we're so stuck in this other muddy part.
That was Rose Eveleth, producer and reporter for the podcast Tested. And because we started the show with Imani Khalif, we just wanted to end with an update. In the final of the women's welterweight division, Imani Khalif, the Algerian, fought Yang Liu of China. And in a unanimous decision from all five judges, Khalif won gold.
Gold medalist and Olympic champion. In red from Algeria, Imani Khalif.
But it's not the end of the controversy over her gender.
The Algerian boxer filing a criminal complaint with Paris prosecutors to get to the bottom of the, quote, misogynistic, racist, and sexist campaign against Khalif, according to her lawyer.
Khalif specifically names Elon Musk, J.K. Rowling, and J.D. Vance, and she doesn't have to prove her gender in court. This is not a defamation hearing. She's taking them to court for online harassment. It's a big deal in an era when athletes' lives can be ruined over social media.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Wilgear's Theatricum Botanicum returns this June 6th through October 4th with outdoor repertory theater, events, and educational programs for all ages. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, alongside Romeo and Juliet, Treasure Island, Noel Coward's Waiting in the Wings, and Bernardo Cubría's dark and incisive new comedy, The People of Pompeii, set in the aftermath of the 2025 Palisades fire. Theatricum is located in Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway, in the shade of the California live oaks. Explore and picnic in the gardens before the show. Further information available at www.theatricum.com and at kpfk.org.
What's going on, family? From the Bay to L.A., my name is Kat Brooks. My show, Law & Disorder, is now on KPFK. Cutting-edge interviews with organizers, culture workers, newsmakers, and freedom fighters. The weekly state terror roundup, resistance in residence with artists using their gifts to change the world, and letters from the inside. That's just a small taste of what this show is about as we seek to expose, agitate, and build. Tune in Monday through Thursday at 8 a.m. on 90.7 or at kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Kurt Elling. You're listening to